Afternoon, everybody. Call the finance committee together. My apologies for being late. This is not what I want to do in the long term. Today we have present Representative Munoz, Representative Guttenberg, Guerra, Representative Costello, myself, Representative Osterman, Representative Wilson, Representative Edgman, Representative Thompson, and Representative Newman. Today we're going to be hearing from Legislative Finance from David Teal, Director, on some of the history of the PERS and TERS system and about the current retirement system and its challenges. Really, the goal of today is to get a baseline, an understanding of how we are, why we got to where we are today, and the amount of money that the unfunded liabilities that people keep talking about. So with that, Mr. Teal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to restate, my name is David Teal. I'm Director of Legislative Finance Division. And there's a fairly lengthy PowerPoint today, certainly a lot longer than the overview slides. And what you'll, the slides today were prepared during the interim for a Senate Finance Committee in. And the focus there was really on the health of Alaska's retirement systems. It's an assessment of the situation aimed at helping people decide whether action is necessary. It's the middle of a three-part series on retirement issues. The first part was deep background or, you know, history at kind of a painful level. And the third part is the discussion of options. So as the chairman said, today is more a discussion of the health of the system. And I think the chair wisely decided to leave discussion of options for a future meeting. Even without looking at options, retirement is pretty technical. And there's simply so much information that people have said that coming up to speed on retirement is like trying to drink out of a fire hose. And I know that your familiarity with the issue varies, that some of you have been around and paying attention to this issue. And that puts me in a bit of an awkward spot because I'm going to be telling some of you things you already know and perhaps assuming a level of knowledge that some of you don't have. So I'll try to keep the fire hose volume down, but that may leave you with lots of questions. I prefer discussion to lectures, so, and much of the later material builds on the early material, so I encourage questions as we go along, and the slides should take an hour or less, so I think there's plenty of time to for questions and still get out of here by 3 o'clock. Fortunately, this committee has an advantage over the Senate Finance Committee, and that's that Pete Eklund has been involved in the changes to the system that occurred more than 5 years ago, and there just aren't that many people around, legislators or staff, who were here and involved in the changes during that time. So I know he's behind me, but if there are questions that are more political in nature, or if my view of history leaves you with questions, I think we can get Pete up to the table to help answer some questions. So, any questions now? No? Well, then I'll start with some of my own. The first slide here is are Alaska's public employee retirement systems healthy, and if not, what do you want to do about it? I'm going to come back to the second question later. My short answer to the first question is that we're not healthy. But that's not very enlightening, and the whole rest of this presentation has to do with information that's what led me to that conclusion. So a lot about actuarial concepts, some policy guidelines, et cetera. The focus is on PERS, but much of the information applies to TERS and to judicial systems as well. And, of course, we'll be limiting the discussion to defined benefits plans. And I hope the reason for that's obvious, but I'm going to explain that briefly. That sure jumped.
Mr. Chairman, do you want questions afterwards? Or?
Well, we appear to be missing slide 3 here.
David?
Yeah.
Do you prefer questions now, or do you want to wait to the end?
I prefer questions as we go.
Okay, can I?
Representative Edgman.
Just in response to this question about whether or not the retirement systems are healthy, I think it bears, and I would agree it's not healthy, but I think it bears comparison to some of the other worst-case scenarios that are around the country with, you know, we've heard about Illinois and Detroit and some of these other states where you see pension shortfalls that are incredibly, they're beyond the reach of you know, almost the local economies. The other thing that I think bears at least a comment on is the fact that our bond rating is AAA. I mean, we're still, I mean, this is within the, even though the sort of the amassed liability is, what, 11, 12 billion or 13 billion or whatever it might be at any given point, you could argue it's still within our reach to correct over time, whereas in some of these other states and municipalities, maybe you couldn't argue that.
Through the chair, that's a good assessment of the situation, that we're not healthy. There are some systems that are healthier than we are. There are some systems that are less healthy. We're at a point that the cost is quite high, but we also have some advantages over other states in terms of cost, and that's that we closed the defined benefit system and are no longer accruing unfunded liability on what's becoming a larger and larger share of our payroll. The defined contributions employees are now up to about 30%, almost a third of the payroll is on the new tier. So, unfortunately, I don't have the slide. Somehow got lost in my electronic version. It's on the paper version, and I was going to explain why we're talking about defined benefits plans and not defined contributions plans when we're looking at health. And that's because under defined contribution plans, the employer pays usually a percent of payroll into an individual retirement account type setup, and that the employer makes no promises as to what those accounts will be worth in future years, and the employee bears the risk that the account will be able to provide sufficient income for his retirement. Anson System Health refers to the likelihood that money will be on hand to pay promised benefits. It doesn't really make any sense to talk about the health of defined contribution plans because there's no risk that the system will be unable to pay promised benefits. There are no because there are no promises, you can't ever be in danger of not making or not fulfilling those promises. So a defined benefits plan, again, the employer typically contributes a percent of payroll, and often they're very similar costs at the time the contributions are made. The defining attribute of a defined benefits plan is that the employer promises to pay a pension. The defined benefit is your pension. And the employer bears the risk and the responsibility of making sure that those benefits can be paid when due. And that's why it's critical to track and maintain the health of a defined benefit plan when it's not that critical on a defined contribution plan. So how do we measure health? It used to be easy. You know that employees accrue pension benefits as they work, and those accrued benefits are an accounting liability to the system. And when the funding ratio, which is simply assets divided by liabilities, is 100% or more, the system is fully funded, meaning it has sufficient assets on hand to pay all anticipated benefits in the future. The funding ratio is measured at a particular point in time, usually annually, and it's a very common way of measuring health and comparing various systems. The second measure is unfunded liability, and that's just the dollar amount of that you owe. The funding ratio puts it in terms of you have 61% of the assets on hand that you need to pay benefits. You could also say you have $7.5 billion of unfunded liability, and they're almost interchangeable terms. We happen to have about $7.5 billion of unfunded liability, and that is, so we only have 61% of the assets in PERS required to pay benefits. I think Representative Guerra had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. He's clairvoyant. I was just making weird arm movements, but I was pondering a question. David, just remind us, I know under the Constitution we cannot change the benefits of those under the pension system. I'm not so sure how accurately I stated that. But is there any option at all, and not that I'm pushing this either way, I'm just curious, is there any option at all for, you know, I'm Tier 2, is there any option at all for changing the ratio of what I and the state pay towards retirement, or that would impact our benefits, and that's not allowed?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's an issue in many other states that are facing problems paying for their benefits. They look at things to do, and one of the obvious ones becomes changing the level of benefits. In most states, including Alaska, that's a constitutional issue. And as you said, you are not able to reduce benefits unilaterally, and so some states have tried doing that. Most states just go forward. They would make a new tier and say everyone hired after this date is affected. Alaska, because we've switched already to defined contributions, doesn't have many options for new tiers for defined benefits people. They're simply here. They are where they are. They work as long as they work, and then they'll retire. So we're not, as I said at the very beginning, we're not allowing any more people into a defined benefit plan, so there's no reason for a new tier that would change the benefits that people get.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Representative Costello.
Thank you, David. The number we usually toss around is $12 billion. Is it? Are you saying 7.5 because we're only talking about PERS, and you're not including TERS?
Through the chair, and that's exactly it.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The unfunded liability has exploded since the implementation of the defined contribution system. What are the factors that have led to such a huge growth in the unfunded liability since 2006?
Through the chair, if I could hold on that question, because it's about a third of this presentation.
Okay.
So I hope that your questions will be answered as we go along.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Till, you said earlier, and I just want to make sure I understood, that the state knows is no longer tracking the liability of the new tier. And if that's right, is anybody tracking it for health care, for, you know, our internal health care system?
Again, through the chair, that's a good point. There's no reason to track the retirement account, the personal account, because, as I, you know, the nature of defined contribution plan is that the employer deposits money and never worries about it again. But technically, we do have a hybrid plan, and that the health portion of our defined contribution plan is actually a defined benefit plan. Employees are promised health and health benefits regardless of the cost or the cost change, so that yes, that portion of health is being tracked. But I guess I simplified and referred to only the what you might call the retirement portion of their benefits.
I'm just concerned that, you know, sometime in the future, some future legislature, you know, is going to want to look back and find out something, a question that we can't even begin to think what it would be, and it's that nobody ever was keeping the data. So, thank you.
Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I guess on the issue of I wouldn't say it's our Constitution prohibits what the Supreme Court has ruled or on in this case. That's their interpretation, obviously, and that becomes the law of the land. I'm not sure how explicit our Constitution prohibits a change. I can't find that section on pensions and benefits, so it's a broader ruling, obviously. But I would sure like just to us being able to better explain. I think we've just always said, well, the courts say we have to do this, and certainly the courts aren't going to come and explain it. They don't. They only talk to us, once a year, and it's a one-way conversation. And then they send emissaries other. And I'm not trying to be pejorative, but it's a very difficult to have this interactive discussion about how we got there. But I think I'll just count myself. I don't have a real clean understanding of that court case or court cases. And it's always struck me as we just had a ruling, Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, on the advice of an assistant attorney general, tossed out an initiative that vaguely may have appropriated, yet the Supreme Court's allowed to appropriate all the time, apparently. And the Constitution is very explicit on where the appropriations powers. In effect, if you take the same thing on a fishing issue and extrapolate it, I don't think it's a very far stretch. The courts have been very aggressive in appropriating or directing appropriations, but they have a lot more power than our citizens, that's for sure. But back to the first point, whether it's Mr. Barnhill probably knows the folks that would come here and explain how we got there, and he probably could explain a lot of it himself at another time. But I sure would feel, I don't know, I don't know if I'd feel more comfortable, but at least I'd be slightly more informed.
Mr. Teely, want to answer that as a question?
Well, it's framing it. That prevented a lot of other questions I don't know how to answer those, and that's how we get to those answers at a future time. It's sure a lot easier talking to our constituents if we have a better understanding of what the Supreme Court tells us to do.
And, Mr. Chairman, my reaction to his comments is, you guys are a tough crowd. Every time I try to simplify something, you bring out these technicalities. And you're right. It, as I said, this is not a simple topic. You could go on about what the Constitution says and how it's been interpreted and, you know, what has happened in other states who try to reduce benefits and argue on constitutional grounds, some have won, some have not. It is not clear, even though we do have a Supreme Court ruling here that makes it more clear. That is, you know, there are all kinds of issues related to how much money you have and whether you can afford to continue to pay benefits. It's a tricky issue.
And, Mr. Chairman, just in closing, I'm sure there's no truth to it, but I've been told by some that our Supreme Court sometimes makes political decisions.
I wouldn't know.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Captain Aguirre.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, when a representative was told said that, I realized I've been taking this on faith forever, my whole life, so I just, and I've never seen the constitutional provision. I've just heard it. Article 12, Section 7, without reading the whole thing, says accrued benefits to these systems shall not be diminished or impaired. That's where the ruling came from. We can argue whether or not the Supreme Court was right or not about it. But
what page are you on?
Page 37, Article 12, Section 7, under retirement systems.
And, Mr. Chairman, even then, what's the definition of accrued? Accrued at the time? Because if that's, then you can change it any time you want. Or is it accrued the day that you were hired and now you have rights to that? It's an issue that's been decided different ways in different states.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Okay. But looking at measuring health, the funding ratio or unfunded liability, either way you want to look at it, isn't good enough. In fact, it's proven that a funding ratio of 100% is no guarantee of long-term health.
The system wasn't in there.
Most systems had funding ratios at or near or even above 100 during the 1990s. And that's because we had a decade of relatively high interest rates, and that resulted in solid asset growth, which translates to high funding ratios. Low contribution rates are a cause of that. And in many cases, when systems were healthy, the response is an expansion of benefits. Fortunately for the Treasury, Alaska did not expand benefits, even though we were at funding ratios of 100. And in fact, as you alluded to, being Tier 2 or Tier 3, we were clearly reducing benefits during the times that many states were expanding them. So I'm going to hold off on this third and fourth measures of health and come back to them later. I think you need more background on funding ratios and unfunded liability before talking about them. So go to the next slide. This chart shows assets and liabilities. The black line here is assets. And the dashed line is liabilities, accrued liabilities. And the funding ratio, which starts in, and the whole series starts in 02, so it's a little hard to tell you from this that we were at 100% for a long time, but we were for several years before this. Then in 2005, this gap opened up quite suddenly, and it wasn't small. It was a $2.5 billion gap. And it caused the funding ratio, this blue line, light blue, to fall from 100% to 75% in a single year. So should you be concerned about this upward trend in liabilities? Not really. An upward trend is expected because you typically have more workers earning more money and accumulating more benefits as time goes on. And that's both health and pension. And unlike many states, Alaska did not increase benefits when the funding ratios are high, and our benefits don't stand out as extraordinarily generous. But mentioning health, it's probably worth pointing out to you that Alaska is one of three states that include health costs in our calculation of our funding ratio and the unfunded liability. So we're relatively better off than the numbers show. And roughly a third, a little bit more than that, is of unfunded liability is due to health costs. So my advice on this issue is to ignore comparisons with other systems. you, if you and others expect to pay those health costs, then you should be including them in the computations. And the purpose of measuring the health of a system is to obtain an honest assessment of where you are. It's not to make yourself look better in comparison with others. And we do include those health costs. So back to the liability curve. You shouldn't be concerned about the upward trend. The trick or the problem is that assets are supposed to keep pace with it. And you can see that assets no longer are on basically overlaying the liability curve. And we have this gap. You can read it as either a funding ratio declining or as a gap increasing. Same thing. So this isn't typically a problem, having our assets keep up with liabilities, because as payroll goes up and benefit accrual goes up, the contributions go up at the same time with little or no change in rates, and everything is fine as long as investments perform as expected. And that's the critical thing, and again, I'm going to repeat that because that's what went wrong here. Everything is fine in a defined benefit system as long as investments perform as expected. So we know that systems were healthy for a long time and that funding ratios hovered near 100 for years. The obvious question is, what happened? How did we and almost everyone else get so unhealthy so fast? And here, the answer is that unfunded liability is a consequence of assumptions that fail to materialize. Now think back to the defining attribute of a defined benefit plan. Employers bear the risk of system health. Unfunded liability is a consequence of risk becoming reality. In other words, when your earnings do not meet your assumptions, you get in trouble. And that's why the funding ratio of 100 is no guarantee of system health, because you saw what happened. In 1 year, we went from 100 to 75, and a $2.5 billion unfunded liability gap. There are two sides to this risk. First, liability is a moving target. If life expectancy increases, if health care costs increase, if anything makes your benefits greater than expected, the funding ratio declines and unfunded liability appears. Just the Mercer case is something you probably have heard of. I don't want to go into great detail. You look back and said something about Mike Barnhill. I don't know if he's
Mercer,
here.
Mercer,
yeah. Yeah. So the Mercer case was one in which what I just said applies. Don't want to go into great deal detail, but they used some outdated assumptions that understated our accrued liability. And the point is that an unexpected increase in your accrued liability, as in correcting a bunch of assumptions that were used to determine health benefits and life expectancy, are corrected, you wind up with, with something like this. And here what happened was you have that sudden jump in liability. That trend would have gone along like this, and suddenly about half of that gap was due to understating our accrued liability. We sued Mercer on that, got a $500,000 settlement, and the assumptions were fixed. So I don't know that there's any point in going into greater detail on the Mercer case. But even if those benefit assumption, or if benefits followed your assumptions, assets can fail to keep pace with your liabilities. And unfortunately, that again is also very easy. And it happened unfortunately, at the same time that benefit assumptions were revised. So roughly half of that $2.5 billion gap was the assumptions, and half was due to losses, investment losses.
Thank you, David. This is more of a matter of curiosity. Just in fairness to the people who devised the system, though there were flaws to it, the high three system I think is very weird. But in fairness to them, if they were just projecting out what we needed to pay people for their pensions, so that people put in for their pensions and then we have enough money to pay the pensions, if they were just focusing on that, but didn't realize that healthcare costs would skyrocket the way they did. We have the highest rate of healthcare costs, healthcare cost increases in the nation and the state, or second highest, and the highest or second highest healthcare costs itself. If healthcare costs hadn't skyrocketed so badly, would we have been close to fully funded, or have you never done that analysis, which would be understandable?
Through the chair, healthcare costs had a big impact on the unfunded liability. It accounts for, as I said, about a third, little more than that, of the unfunded liability because the assumptions were inaccurate. But it's hard to separate the healthcare costs from the life expectancy and some of the other assumptions that understated liability. I can't tell you exactly how much is due to healthcare, but if what you're getting at is would we have been closer, or would we have reduced unfunded liability if healthcare costs hadn't taken off? Yes, but this is what happens in a defined benefit system, is that they're designed to automatically fill that gap of unfunded liability, and they do it over a 25-year period. Other states use different amortization periods if they choose to. But you fill that gap by making small adjustments to rates. Now, that's always worked in the past, that you with small adjustments in rates, the gap was filled. And now we'll talk about filling the gap a little bit. Actuaries calculate the amount of benefits that are expected to be earned and the health care costs during the upcoming year. They also calculate how much you're going to pay out during the year in benefits. So assuming that you're at a funding ratio of 100 and want to stay there, your assets have to increase by the same amount as your change in accrued liability. And I'll just go through a little model here. I'm going to switch to Excel to do that. I hope this answers that question. Why has unfunded liability not been an issue in the past? What changed? And this shows you a real simple example. It's an oversimplified actuarial model. Let's just say that we start at $12 billion in assets. We also have $12 billion in liabilities. So our funding ratio is 100%. That's where we were in 2004. We paid about $1 billion in benefits, and so you pay it out, it reduces your liabilities by $1 billion as well. So now you have net assets of 11, but your liabilities are 11, and of course during the year employees earned more benefits, so your accrued liability actually goes up. At the same time, you have earnings during the year. We assume here that you're going to earn 8%. So 8% on your $12 billion and is $920 million. And you can say, Ben, or now what does the actuary do? They say, you need to recover this $1,350, $1.35 billion. You get $920 of it through earnings. You need to collect $430 of it from employers and employees. And you divide that $430 million into the payroll and say your rate is 17.9%. Okay, it's more complicated than this, but I think this gets you through the conceptual steps. Now, what happens is let's take an example, because nothing about an actuarial model is certain. So what I want to do is walk you through some of the things that happened to us, and assuming here that the actuaries were right on the nose with their assumptions about benefits and accrued liabilities and the contribution rate required to recover. So the real problem here is earnings, because you're assuming in advance that you're going to earn 8% and determining your contribution rate based on that earnings assumption. So now let's say that you only earn 7%. Well, instead of earning $920 million, you only earned $805. Your contributions came in where they were supposed to, but you've got $115 million of unfunded liability. Not a huge problem, because if you're assuming 8% average over time, you know, you earn 7% in 1 year, 9% the next year. Well, now you're taking that unfunded liability and starting the next year with your assets, liabilities, this carries forward. And now you add something to your normal contributions. And defining normal contributions, that's the rate that generates sufficient assets, assuming all your assumptions come true. When they don't come true, and here we're just looking at the earnings assumption not coming true, then you can generate unfunded liability. The normal rate covers the costs if they do come true. This unfunded liability is covered through past service costs, is what they call them. And that just takes this $115 million, amortizes it over 25 years so that you recover it. But you don't necessarily have to recover it over that 25-year period, because the unfunded liability can go away by itself. Here, if we just earn 9% in the next year, then your earnings are above what you expected, and you've got some contributions coming in that you wanted, that were imposed to recover that unfunded liability, but they're pretty small. Bottom line is, your unfunded liability went from 115 to 2. This is why rates don't change very much, is because as long as you're within a fairly narrow band of earnings, the system recovers by itself with small changes in contribution rates. But as you add volatility to your interest rates, let's start with 6 and 10. So we still got an average rate of 8%, but now much more unfunded liability generated. But it doesn't matter, because the 10% mostly recovered. But as soon as you start getting more volatility in there, and here we can go to 4 and 12, greater liability, and you do not pay it off the next year. Well, let's take a look at interest earnings during the past couple years. They look like this. Some good years, 15, 16, even over 20%. Also some bad years where we lost 20%. Much more volatility than this 4 and 12% range. And the average rate of return for the last 5 years has been 1.4%. So that there's a real problem when you start saying, what if I lose 21%? you end up with a huge unfunded liability opening up. And now if you want to keep the average at 8, you'd have to earn 37% the next year. And that was great, but you still got $1 billion in unfunded liability. You'd have to earn over 50% to offset that 1 year of losses, of a 21% loss. The system never anticipated that much volatility in your earnings. It was designed to look at bond returns, which are pretty stable, and the contribution rates would then stay fairly stable, and unfunded liability would essentially take care of itself just by averaging around, small deviations from your average rate. One more thing here I should probably mention, and that's that let's say you lost, or you didn't lose, you assumed you were going to earn 8%, but you didn't, you only earned 7. And the following year, you did better than recovering to an average of 8. Well, your unfunded liability went away, and now you're overfunded. So the system can take care of itself if your earnings volatility is small. We didn't have small volatility. So what you should remember so far is that earnings are volatile, they're unpredictable. Small variations can be addressed by smoothing, amortization, and good fortune. And smoothing is just a 5-year moving average. It's probably not worth spending a whole lot of time on. And when variations are small, you may not actually have to pay any unfunded liability through contributions at all. You can recover by the interest rate. And that's why this is sometimes called, unfunded liability is called a soft liability. It's not like issuing a bond and you have payments of this amount that you must pay year by year. In fact, many states made the mistake of thinking that the unfunded liability gap that opened up was soft and that they didn't have to respond. They didn't raise their contribution rates, and they're in trouble because if you don't raise your rates, the gap gets larger. It gets harder and harder to close that gap, and that soft liability becomes firmer and firmer until you get to the point where Illinois, and I would argue that Alaska, is in the same situation where you can no longer count on high earnings to close the gap. It's now turned into a debt that we need to pay.
This is all very interesting. What comes to mind is, doesn't the state take on above 22.5% for PERS and above 12.5% for TERS? So raising rates would have ended up in the state's lap anyway. Is that not the case?
Through the chair, because we cap employer rates, and I'll get to that in a few minutes, any increase in the rate simply shows up as additional state assistance. Employers do not pay.
Follow up.
Okay.
So with our constitutional budget reserve, we have two accounts, one that is more aggressively invested, that we are assuming more risk and volatility, and then a more conservative long-term account. Are these investments all done with the same philosophy in terms of the investing?
Through the chair, they're not. The The 8% return on retirement investments is something that they believe they can achieve, because in theory the assets are invested for a very long time. And they can do that because you've got contributions coming in every year. That gives you the cash flow that you need to pay your benefits, so that you don't have to worry about spinning off cash flow to make benefit payments. Now, as long as that's true, they can earn 8%. The permanent fund has lowered its earnings target. The CVR in their aggressive account earns near that, and in the main account, which is has a shorter time frame, earns half of that. So yes, your time horizon and your investment objectives definitely influence your rate of return. And we'll get to that later, because it's critical that as our system changes, I don't believe it's possible to continue to make 8% because of liquidity concerns. Where does the cash come from to make the benefit payments when contributions go away? And that's really a topic that comes up more when we talk about the options, the staying where we are versus the governor's plan or other options that may be out there. So next week for that? Okay, some other things here is that when you have big losses, and we did have big losses, not just in 2005, but remember the losses of 2008 and 2009, they can be so large that the system appears to be broken. You simply do not have the assets on hand anymore to recover, even with very high interest rates. But the good news on that one is the system is unlikely to stay broken in the long run. All you have to do is pay what you owe, and the system will fix itself. Of course, that's easier said than done when pay what you owe starts becoming unaffordable. But all of this is a model, and I'm not sure how much you trust models. I mean, I build them all the time, and I don't believe them. So they're the best we can do. But they don't necessarily come true. And as time passes, all those assumptions in the model are going to be replaced with the real earnings that you made. So if you assumed an earnings rate that was too high in your model, you're going to get unfunded liability, and unfunded liability makes your contribution rates go up. Now, as you pointed out, employers won't pay that additional contribution rate, but the state will. So the system will recover. So onto the third measure of health. It's paying what you owe. And credit raters are the primary users of this measure, because they believe that paying what you owe to a retirement system reflects on your ability and your commitment to pay your other debts, which they're really interested in. I mean, they're bond raters. They want to know the credit worthiness. And they're basing that on your ability to pay other debts. So it may appear that paying while you go is less technical than other measures, but the calculation of what you owe is actually pretty complex, and it's controversial. And that's because, to some degree, determining what you owe is a matter of choice. You can determine your amortization rate, you can determine the interest rate that you use. And those interest rates and amortization things will give you great differences in your unfunded liability and your unfunded liability, which will determine how much contributions you have to make. So what the credit raters discovered was that the models used by various states to rate their own systems were not useful to them because they had all kinds of different assumptions. And of course, their objective is to compare the credit worthiness of one government, whether it's a municipality or a state, to another. So they came up with a common set of assumptions and rerun everything. But we should really be more concerned about ourselves than about comparing ourselves with others, in my opinion. So I'm less concerned about the bond raters model than I am about our own. And I wasn't going to talk about options today, but I think I need to get you started thinking about something that will may affect your attitude on various options. And that's that the cost of paying benefits is identical under any option, as long as you accept the model assumptions, and unless you choose to try to change benefits in some way. I mean, but I don't think that we're looking at changing benefits. What I'd like to say is that those options are similar to the options one faces when you buy a home. You're not necessarily looking for the cheapest option, which would be to pay cash for it. You're looking for the most affordable option, which may mean a 30-year mortgage instead of a 15-year mortgage. So that brings us to the fourth measure of system health, which I just call affordability. It's the least technical measure of system health, and it was a big deal during the discussions that resulted in adopting a defined contribution plan and moving from individual pensions plans to a cost-sharing plan. And here I think it's time for a bit of a history lesson. We already discussed the sudden appearance of unfunded liability in 2005. We talked a little bit about what happens when earnings don't meet expectations. That occurred in 2008 and 9, and we opened up huge unfunded liability gaps during those years. But even the 2005 loss opened many legislators' eyes to the financial risk that employers face with the defined benefit system. And there, the legislature adopted a defined contribution plan for both PERS and TERS. Didn't do it for JRS, the judicial retirement system, and that's something that you may want to think about now. Defined contribution plan is the ultimate pay-as-you-go plan. You put money in, you can never owe any more money to that system. But the defined contribution plan affected only new employees. So then you have to figure out what to do with all those existing defined benefit plans and the massive debt that we'd already incurred. So even amortizing that unfunded liability over 25 years would have resulted in some employers paying extremely high contribution rates. The worst one I remember was Fairbanks at about 180% of payroll. I don't know how you can expect any employer to contribute 180% of payroll to a retirement system and survive. Many employers faced rates they couldn't pay, even 30, 40, 50, 60%, and that was back in 2007, before we lost more money. So, now the state also had some accounting difficulties during this time, and many of those are brought on by, I'll use a simple example that you don't have to go very far out of this room to see it apply. I was talking to the chairman yesterday, and here's just sort of an example of why the accounting under the existing defined benefit plan, in which every government was had its own plan, its own part of the trust fund, and was responsible for its share of benefits and paid rates based on individually determined benefits and liabilities. So let's say a person worked 10 years for the school board and got paid $150 a month, then moved on to the assembly, worked another 10 years at $300 a month, and then moved on to be a bureaucrat earning $90,000 a year. Well, with 30 years of service, you're going to retire on about two-thirds of pay, or $60,000. So each employer would be responsible for a third of that, because one-third of the service was put in at each of those employers. Now, the school district had fully reserved for this person earning $150 a month or $1,800 a year, and had 10 years of service, which gets you maybe 20%. So you're thinking, there's a retirement I've got to reserve for at $360 a year. And what happens is they get a bill not for $360, but for one-third of the $60,000 that person gets in benefits. They don't have anywhere near enough in reserves to pay for that. And when a lot of that happens, it is an accounting problem. I don't know how bad it was. In reality, all I can say is that it resulted in individual employer rates with a great deal of variability. And some people threatened a lawsuit. Some municipalities threatened a lawsuit. I'm not sure how bad the records were or whether they actually even filed that lawsuit. The new law made the issue moot because it said we're going to a shared cost plan. All the liabilities are pooled, and every employer will pay the same blended rate. Most employers paid a higher rate than the state did in those years, so going to a blended rate was an advantage to them, like Fairbanks, where the rate would have been 180%. They would have had a big decline in rates. But those that didn't have higher rates were held harmless and got the new blended rate phased in. So even the blended rates were problematic. They were at the recommended rate for fiscal year 8 was nearly 40% of payroll and was expected to increase for several years, even under the best of circumstances, so that municipalities claimed they needed rates that were stable, predictable, and affordable. That brings up the 22% cap that you, Representative Costello, mentioned. And that was a solution that the state and the municipalities came to, because the state knew that they could not expect municipalities to pay 40% rates without going bankrupt. So the solution was to limit the rate to 22% for PERS, 12.5% for TERS, and the state would pick up any costs above that. Well, yesterday I went back and reviewed a presentation that I gave in April of 2007. My conclusion at that time was that the rate caps met two of the municipalities' concerns. They were absolutely stable. They were absolutely predictable. And that 22% cap was intended to go through the early 30s, mid-30s, until the last defined benefit person retired. The model prepared by the actuary at that time showed that the state would pay about $50 million on behalf of employers in 2008. That would increase to a peak of about $70 million in 10 and then decline steadily and be less than $30 million a year after 2017. Now, remember that the state had a surplus at the time, and it looked like an affordable long-term solution, particularly when you remember that the state is also an employer, capped at 22%, and that the state has about 60% of that payroll. So really only 40% of this state assistance is something that you might call municipal assistance. The rest of it is paying the state's own bill. So perhaps the lesson here is to take actuarial models with a grain of salt. As you've seen, state assistance did not fade away into the sunset. It grew and grew, and then it exploded to $700 million this year. And it's heading for over $1 billion annually. Now, addressing this issue wasn't critical when we had a budget surplus.
David, before you leave, one thing out there, and that is the 22% versus the 40% that would have was proposed at one point in time. So the above 22% that the state is currently paying is the same 22% that they started in 2007, I think you said. So over the years, the state continues to give revenue sharing basically to all the municipalities to cover the cost of their employees' retirements.
Yes.
And so the same, but it's the same today as it was in 2007. We're still paying that above.
Correct. The rate was set at 22%, and that's in statute. So the statute has not been changed. We're still paying, we, the state, and all other PERS employers are paying 22%. The difference is that the state's share of costs, everything above 22%, has gone up and up and up. And that's, again, we lost 20% of our portfolio. And, you know, you're supposed to make 8% on a $10 billion portfolio. You're expecting to make $800 million in a year. And if you lose 20%, you're losing $20 million. You're $2.8 million behind where you thought you'd be. Well, you need to recover that, but the employers pay the same 22% that they used to pay. The state picks up all of the additional unfunded liability.
I just wanted clarity on that. Thank you.
So the thinking on what some might call a failure to address this issue earlier was really that we might be paying too much into retirement plans, but we know we've got a huge debt out there. It's not a soft liability anymore. It's a debt. And better to pay it now when we have a surplus than to have to pay it later when that surplus may not be available. When the surpluses turn into deficits, then we'll worry more about reducing state costs. And until then, those extra costs or extra payments made by the state simply reduce the magnitude of the future problem. Well, 2 years ago, it appeared that it was time to start being concerned about the state's ability to pay either the current or the projected level of state assistance. And the result of that concern was SB 187, which called for a cash infusion and reduced state assistance in the future. The Armed Board opposed it, the governor opposed it, and it gained no traction whatsoever. Well, times change. The concern about a deficit has turned into a real deficit at this point, and forecasts of future deficits. And you now become concerned about fiscal stress or affordability, however you want to state that. At the most recent NCSL Pension Task Force meeting, which I was a member of, I discovered that I wasn't alone in thinking that financial stress or fiscal stress was an important measure of system health. There's a lot going on nationally with retirement systems. There's revised GASB rules, and GASB is the Government Accounting Standards Board. They've changed their rules for pension accounting. There are new computations by Moody's and the other bond raters. And there's now a separation of pension accounting and pension funding. So that task force was concerned that all those standards and the calculations would be confusing to both the public and legislators. They made some recommendations, but until this year, those GASB standards were used for accounting, for the bond rating, and for the funding decisions that legislators make. Now there are separate calculations for each of those. The accountants now have to report net pension liability, so they don't call it UL or unfunded liability anymore. It's the same thing, but there's a new name for it. And they have to report it on the balance sheets. Didn't used to do that. Municipalities will now be reporting their share of the unfunded liability on their balance sheets. The old view was that this was like a debt, but for some reason, if you were paying your debt on time, they didn't make you report it on your balance sheet. It would be similar to saying, what's your net worth? And don't worry about your mortgage, because as long as you're making your mortgage payments, you don't have to tell us that you owe money on a mortgage. So no problem, personally, with what they've done. The rating agencies, as we already mentioned, said we can't compare these various governments and their creditworthiness when everybody uses different assumptions. They said we are getting a common set of assumptions, and they ran every retirement system in the country through their own assumptions. The result was some downgrades in the bond ratings. Alaska was not downgraded. I talked to the Moody's rater at one of these pension board meetings, and he said that basically there was no danger of that because Alaska hadn't closed its retirement system, which was a huge step, fiscal responsibility, that we were paying what we were supposed to pay, and that pensions, although we had a large debt, was only a portion of the rating agency's model, so that it was not a big issue for them. And then, of course, we have large reserves, which calm every bond rater's nerves. So, to me, the big thing in GASB rules is that they no longer offer any guidance to legislators. We used to have a model that said you must pay the actuarially required contributions. It's gone. It's as if they expect that people will read municipal or the state's comprehensive annual financial statement and be outraged at the amount of debt attributable to pensions, come in and talk to you and say, what are you going to do about this? I don't know exactly why GASB backed off on the funding guidance, but you no longer have any rules that you must follow when it comes to paying off the unfunded liability. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. David, if you're going to get to the governor's proposal later, then I'll just ask you about that. I just didn't see it in your presentation, and I see a couple.
I had a couple questions about that. So if you're going to get to it later, I'll ask later. If not, I wouldn't mind asking a couple questions now.
Through the chair, I think I can answer for you on that one. Representative Osterman asked me specifically to hold off on a discussion of options until next week or whenever that meeting will be when we discuss the governor's plan and other options.
I wanted a chance for everybody to kind of get to the bottom of where we are today first.
Sure.
Representative Stoltz.
Well, thanks. I'll get to the bottom. No, it's, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I stepped out for a minute. I was trying to watch it on TV while I was multitasking. But the premise of the 8% payoff, and I heard you talk a little bit about that. And how critical is that? I mean, kind of thinking of a high school coach will tell his athletes he wants 110% out of them, which, I mean, you can wish for one thing. And then I always think, well, why not 120 if you're going to go over something that's not realistic anyway? And but going back to the 8%, we've built in this premise. And if that's faulty, or if it's off by a percent or 2%, or in the case of on a $10 billion, if you're expecting $800 million and you lose 20%, you're down $2.8 billion. How many years does that take you to make that up? And but just the moving that one digit or two digits, and does that, if we're operating on a flimsy premise of 8%, If that's an accurate characterization that it's not reliable, do we get to a point we could be like we're trying to fill up, we're doing an oil change, we never put the drain plug in, and we get all kinds of problems. Maybe that's a bad analogy, but or an imperfect one. But how, I guess the crux is, What's the sensitivity of dependence on, and what are our dangers of relying on 8%, and what if it's 7, and what if it's 5? Does it matter how much money we put in? And then,
through the chair, it's absolutely critical to the system. If you do not earn 8%, and if you wanted to change the model right now, you would add billions of dollars to the unfunded liability by changing the interest rate assumption by a full percentage point. So,
Mr. Chairman, this isn't. This wouldn't necessarily have to be the same payout as a trust. A trust is indefinite by nature. This, I think, we're operating under a premise that we expect it to reach a point where we run out of beneficiaries. Does that make the difference between why you'd grasp, you'd shoot for that higher number when foundations use more sustainable amounts? Because this doesn't have to be sustainable at some point, or is it? I'm confused.
Through the chair, I think that it will be easier to answer those questions when you talk about some of the things, because that's what I would say is wrong with the current way we're addressing the thing, and simply trying to build up a big balance and then coast. Because
that's the premise we're operating on, though.
That is the premise we're operating on, is that we will build up enough money in the fund so that contributions will fall to zero in the mid-2030s, and that you will rely from that point on earnings on your assets to pay benefits for the next 40 years. So if you're going to not earn 8%, you have a major problem. And as we discussed, how can you expect to earn 8% when the reason you're earning 8% is because your long-term investment horizon allows you to use, which is allowed because you've got contributions coming in to make your benefit payments. With no cash flow coming in, and as you say, the drain plugs out, you're still paying those benefits.
Wasn't a bad analogy.
No, it wasn't a bad analogy. That how much oil is in the tank? Because if you do not pour enough oil in, and oil is draining out faster than you thought, but your earnings.
Are we talking about tax policy now?
We're talking about oil for some reason, oil taxes. But the analogy is, it's cash flow. You got money flowing in through earnings. You got money flowing out through benefits. The assumption here is that if you earn 8%, you'll have just enough money to pay your benefits. If you earn 7%, then you will not have enough money to pay your benefits. Okay, and over a 40-year period, the difference between 7 and 8% is billions and billions of dollars. That's kind of my point on the governor's proposal or the way we're going now, is that you're relying on a continued return of 8%. If we don't earn it and you have no contributions, who's going to pay the difference? And I think it will be the state.
It would be the state. You're correct. Kind of the way I look at it, that this whole subject is something that needs to have a very in-depth discussion among the full legislature, and it may be addressed and pushed from this committee. But you know, we could take all of our savings right now and bail out our unfunded liability with PERS and TERS, and then 2 years from now, we could have another 2008, 2009, and we'd be right back in the exact same spot we are today. So, and that's the dynamic part of this whole thing that we have to really sit down and address at some point in time. We may not be able to get it during the 90 days we're here, but it's something that bothers me, that we're at the liability. I mean, 2004, 2005, the stock market changed on 20 points and 25 points, everybody was excited. Today, it changes at 200 and 200 and 300 and 400 and 500 points. It takes that much to get people excited. So, you know, the whole system that we have right now is off kilter, and so at some point in time, we're going to have to come back and address this as a more in-depth discussion that we're going to have. We're not going to get it done today, obviously, but...
Even though there wasn't a definitive answer, Mr. Chair, that was useful. It gives me a lot more caution that we need to know a heck of a lot more before we make a major decision when we pull one of these levers. I think that's, even though I didn't get a direct answer, there's not that's an answer in itself.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably not to stray any further than anybody else has, and we'll leave the major discussion as you've requested. But it's always concerned me that the state can't make the returns that individuals can, because we have to be more cautious with the money. And so we're not going to make 8%. And by putting a cash infusion in, we limit the exposure of the risk. And and now we don't have new people putting in because. We've gotten rid of the pension system, so that hurts more. But to break bread with the governor, I mean, Representative Guttenberg and I have had a similar proposal in the past, so we would be fake if we started running away from something we said we liked. But it minimizes the risk, sort of the way paying down your mortgage a little more quickly reduces the amount of money you have to pay over the long term. Yeah, there are going to be these big swings in the stock market, but if you minimize the amount that you owe during those big swings, you get hurt less. Bigger discussion later, but that's the attractiveness to me to start paying some of this down.
Okay. Thank you. Well, this is some advice from the National Pension Funding Task Force. In the face of no more guidelines from GASB, that legislatures should put the funding guidelines in statute. They should describe how you're computing your payments, and they should show the plan to pay the unfunded liability off, and they should offer a way for the public to track how well you're doing on a year-by-year basis. Are you following the plan, essentially? And second, they're saying that the numeric approach, the funding ratio, the unfunded liability calculations, that's sound guidance. But they're not the most important measure of system health. What really matters is what's affordable. Now, think about that for a second, and you realize that 2 years ago, there were large budget surpluses, and state assistance was just one more large appropriation. But basically, there was enough money to pay that appropriation and almost everything else you wanted to do, and we were still saving money. Well, the funding ratio hasn't changed since then, and I guess I'd say that 2 years ago, the systems were healthy by definition. We could afford to make the payments, clearly. Now, with the funding ratio at essentially the same level, the health of the systems deteriorated substantially. But that's because the state treasury can no longer afford the path we're on, let alone the path with increased payments. So you've gone from healthy to very unhealthy in 2 years. It's not because we owe anymore. It's because we can't afford to pay the state assistance anymore because of other circumstances, our revenue and expenditure numbers that we talked about during the overview. So you can look at some numbers. This was kind of the missing graph that some people had mentioned during the overview. It shows that those three cost drivers, K-12, Medicaid, and retirement assistance, now take over 62% of our available revenue. And that if revenue forecast holds true and the growth assumptions in those three cost drivers holds true, they will take 99% of our available revenue by FY22. Well, that leaves virtually no money for agency operations or a capital budget. And, we're not here to debate the revenue projections or the precise amount that these drivers are going to consume. The point is that the mismatch between revenue and expenditures is unsustainable. And if you accept the fact that we cannot afford the projected payments to retirement under the current path, and the systems are unhealthy, then you might want to know what we can do about it. First, you might want to look to what other states are doing. They're trying to change the path of that liability curve, mostly. They can increase assets, try to, but the only way to really increase assets is to increase earnings, which the assumptions are already fairly high for those earnings. So what they want to do is increase contributions, but employers can't afford that, so they're turning to the employees. Sometimes it's just future employees, sometimes it's they go back and try to get it from current employees. You can reduce benefits, raising the retirement age, increasing service requirements, changing from high three to high five, not adjusting for cost of living, all kinds of things you could do. But none of those things that other states are doing do much more than a small but growing change over a long period of time. Now, I don't want to belittle those changes. They can amount to billions of dollars over a long period of time, and they have few other options. But I've not heard of any proposals to tweak our benefit system, reduce our benefits, or increase our employee contributions. And that doesn't put us behind other states. it puts us way ahead of other states because we acted early and hard. We got out of the defined benefits business and went to defined contributions. That didn't do this small changes to the liability curve, which still trends upward. What we did was close the system to new entrants. And that results in this radical change in our benefit curve. We will continue to accrue more benefits for a while because there are lots of defined benefit people still working. But by about 2030, the benefits peak and then begin to go down, and we are out of the business in 2070 or 2080. So it's a long coast down that curve, but it does peak and turn downward, and that puts us way, way ahead of other states that who still have an increasing curve. Now, that downward trend allows us to move away from the standard actuarial approach in which assets have to chase the liability curve upward. How else are you going to close that unfunded liability gap when your liabilities are essentially set by statute, can't reduce them by constitution, etc.? So here we are at roughly $15 billion in assets, and the current plan that we're on says you've got 25 years to go from $15 billion up to here and close that gap. We want to essentially go up and meet that liability curve at some point so we have a 100% funding ratio, and then we're healthy. But the goal really should be to pay all benefits when due and end up with no money left when the curve reaches zero, which raises some interesting questions. Why do we want to chase this liability curve up, build our assets up until we reach the liability curve at its peak? Why can't we go straight across? Why can't we just go down and say, well, we'll keep a balance of $10 billion and aim for here? Why can't we start from where we are and end straight for the bottom of the curve? We don't need a big balance out there. The only reason you have a big balance is so contributions can go to zero and you can coast on your interest earnings. So we'll get to those questions next week. That's really looking at some of these options. Now, a second method of finding options to address what to do is to look at recommendations from the pension task force. They said that pension funding policies, which they hope you incorporate in statutes, should be based on actuarially determined contribution rates. Okay? And set it in statute so it's clear to everybody. I think that's doable once you agree on a plan. Now, number two says collect a consistent percentage of payroll. Use the level percent of pay amortization method. There's a little conflict there because the ARM board recommending changing amortization methods. I don't think it's worth talking about amortization methods here because the ARM board has since then apparently adopted or supported the governor's proposal, and I don't think that level dollar is going to be talked about as an option anymore. The only thing you need to know about setting that actuarial contribution rate is that that's a method that's designed for open systems. New entrants are joining all the time. It requires that percent of pay method. If you're a closed system and no more people can join, you don't need to do that anymore. Now, number three is be disciplined. Ensure that promised benefits can be paid. To me, I just call that put your plan in statute, follow your plan. And I would say you can do that, again, if the plan is affordable. So the fourth one is maintaining intergenerational equity, which simply means that the cost of benefits should be paid by the generation of taxpayers that got the services that were provided by the employees. So, in other words, it's don't move our debts forward so that our children pay them. You should be paying for retirement costs while those people are working. But I'll get back to that one. I think it's probably easier to clear up number five and then return to the intergenerational equity point. Clear reporting. Well, that just shows when your plan is going to be fully funded and whether you're making progress as you intended to towards that plan. But on intergenerational equity, I would say that unfunded liability is not a normal cost. And remember, the normal cost here is what it takes to pay an employee's benefits, assuming all your assumptions come true. I absolutely agree with intergenerational equity when it comes to paying the pension that the best model you could come up with told you you were going to owe. But unfunded liability is not a normal cost, and it can't be paid in a way that maintains intergenerational equity. Chairman, you cited one example there, and that's, let's assume a person retires in 2004. Unfunded liability was zero. His expected benefits were all paid for by the generation that he served. He retires, and you got all the money on hand to pay his expected benefits. And then came big losses in 2005 or 2010, whenever. Well, if there is a loss, unfunded liability is created. The contribution rates must rise to fill that gap. And what that means is the next generation pays for that person. He's retired, gone from the system. There's no way that you're even paying on him anymore. Now, in the defined benefit system, the employer takes the risk, and the employer has to pay when that unfunded liability gap opens. Doesn't matter who the unfunded liability is attributable to. Now, Buck's actuarial model, Buck is the state accountant, or actuary, pardon? Still. That was Mercer that we fired?
Lost.
Buck's actuarial model shows that unfunded liability is fully paid by the 2030s. Why? Because existing unfunded liability is fully amortized by that time, and the model never develops any unfunded liability that's new. Why? Because you always earn exactly what you assumed you would earn. If you don't earn what you assumed you were going to earn, there is going to be unfunded liability opening up. So this is what the actuarial model says. You accrued liability, and this is kind of stretched out, but it's the same curve as we've been showing you before. Your liabilities go up, peak, and slowly begin to turn downward. Buck says, we've got to climb up there. We're at about $12 billion now, and we need to contribute until we get a trust fund of $25 billion. Now, when you reach your $25 billion, you're 100% funded, contributions stop, and you coast from there on with no contributions. But we know that if earnings are less than 8% in 2040 or 50 or any time, you're going to open up new unfunded liability. There's no defined benefits employees left working. There's no employer contribution, so how do you fill it? Well, the state pays. But the, so my conclusion is that costs can and probably will continue long after the last DB, defined benefit employee, retires, and that the state is going to be paying any costs that open up. So my conclusion is that obsession with intergenerational equity can lead to overly restrictive policy decisions. The concept doesn't apply to unfunded liability, and if you want intergenerational equity, you're going to have to go to a defined contribution plan. The onboard sideboards, which regarding intergenerational equity and shifting cost from the state to the munis, can't even be followed by the onboard's proposals. And I don't think that you should be held to the sideboards that they want to impose if their own models cannot comply. It's not that they don't, it's impossible to comply with those sideboards. But let's try to look at it in a more positive way. I don't object to a cash infusion. In fact, that was I worked on a cash infusion model more than 2 years ago. The governor's proposal, the arm board's proposal, any contribution or cash infusion model works. But what's the goal and how do you achieve it? I think the goal is a healthy system. And here I'm not looking at funding ratios or anything like that. I'm looking at being able to eliminate the unfunded liability in a reasonable time at an affordable cost. And pay your benefits when due, which probably should be on here, but it's, you know, I was looking at what's the goal on unfunded liability. So there are several things we could do. We could reamortize our outstanding unfunded liability and stretch it out, but that would reduce state assistance in the short run. It doesn't really save you any money. It's like refinancing your home longer term without a change in interest rates. You're paying more interest in the long run. You could change the assumptions used in the model. But that's just games. I mean, it's reality that matters. And that model, if it isn't the best reflection of your expectations, you're just fooling yourself because you're relying on that model to make decisions. So you need to have it be the best model you can have. You can eliminate health care from the unfunded liability calculation. But those costs are real. And if you expect to pay them, then you really need to continue to include them. Or you can look for more workable options that don't rely on assumptions that no additional unfunded liability will open up at some point in the future. Or that we continue to earn 8% returns when we know that liquidity requirements are going to constrain those returns. As a wrap-up, I think you need to understand that action on funding is not imperative. You do not have to do anything here. You are on a track to reach full funding. The primary issue is the affordability of staying on that track. And concluding advice, whatever you decide to do, even if it's staying on the current path, you should outline your plan in statute, not merely appropriate money annually. And you should avoid the following situations: paying less than the plan and paying more than you can afford. So that's kind of the stopping point until we get back to talk about the options and how they are affected by some of the actuarial concepts that we've talked about today.
Thank you, Mr. Teal. Two things, and I've talked to you about them before, or at least one of them before. One of them is the is the list of employers, meaning municipalities and school districts, and such that, and what is their share? If reality base is that the real share of the state is 60% because of our employees, and that leaves 40% left for what the other employers would be putting in. So I'd like to see a list of all of those. Oh, you've got it right there.
I had it on my thumb drive, but
I don't want to try to go through it right now, but I think it's something that should be provided to the community and have everybody have an opportunity to go through and actually see what the different potential liabilities are for other municipalities and other employers. The other thing is the state's already paying above 22% and has been since 2007. What is that bill that we've paid as a state? What is the total bill we paid since 2007 that would have normally been picked up by the munis if we hadn't capped it at 22%? So if you
okay. Yeah, I can come back with that. I mean, we do have the list of payroll by municipality and by school district so that we can come back and, you know, I didn't do it for everybody, but I just did it for Anchorage to see what happened. Their payroll is $25 million a year. Their percentage of payroll is 8.2%. So their share of the unfunded liability is $650 million. One option here, and I don't think it's a serious option, but we could say we're tired of this. We're paying our share in a lump sum, and everybody else should pay their share in a lump sum. So, or, you know, we're not paying state assistance anymore. Your share, Anchorage, is $650 million. Would you like to pay that in a lump sum? Would you like to pay it over 5 years or 10 years or 25 years or what? But just so you know, why that idea doesn't work is that if Anchorage opted to pay it over 25 years, their bill would be $60 million a year, which is 32% of their payroll. And that's on top of the normal contributions. So you'd be saying, Anchorage, your contributions are now 42%, essentially getting out of the business of the state making these liability payments. And I can fill in those kinds of calculations for every city if you want.
Let's get the calculations done up and bring it so that we have it in front of us and we get to talk about options. And I want to have an apples-to-apples conversation, and I don't think we're having that. I think okay. that with the way that the state picks up those extra costs, that is not an apples-to-apple discussion. So further comments or questions today? Representative Munoz.
Just following up that point, on that point, we also pay 100% of past obligation. Isn't that correct? Prior to 2007?
Through the chair, no.
No.
The obligation is recomputed every year so that there is no 100% of obligations at some point in time and then 22% it's
okay.
It's redone every year.
So if I can follow up, prior to 2007, what was the breakdown between the local governments and the state?
Through the chair, the proportion was exactly even. I mean, that everybody paid a rate. There was no state assistance. So if Juneau had experience that said your share is, well, it's not a share because it wasn't a shared system or a blended rate. It was, Juneau, your rate may be 17. Anchorage's may be 12. North Slope's may be 21. It was all over. Now, when we became a shared system, that meant that no more variability in rates. Everybody pays the same blended rate based on the shared liability of the system. and the shared payroll. That rate was about 40%. And again, we said munis cannot do that. And that's why the cap was set at 22 and the state pays everything after that.
Representative Costello.
Oh, thank you. Through the chair, David, I don't see this problem. This is not our only problem that we're facing. And because we're facing other major problems, I mean, this morning we learned that by 2022 we'll have a Medicaid bill of $7 billion. So if we're going to consider all of the problems that we're facing right now, isn't the timing of when we most need cash at hand going to be an important distinction here? Because I see it as a delicate timing issue, not just isolated to the pension problem. So your comment that this can almost take care of itself because the curve goes down at some point, but when you look at when it goes down, we also have other obligations that come to a head at that same point. And so it's my understanding that we want to essentially reduce our monthly or annual payment to free up that other money that we're going to be using for state services. And that is where that's the value judgment that we have to make that has to actually has to take into consideration all of these other fiscal issues that we're talking about. And I wondered if you could comment on that.
Through the chair, I didn't mean to imply that retirement, if you address the retirement issues, it would take care of those other issues. I think all those issues are related, and you need to think of them together. Certainly in 2007, they were combined. It wasn't a matter of just retirement reform. The education, retirement, and revenue sharing were all tied together and solved as a common solution, because I think there were people who realized that you can't solve one and then move on to the next. You have to look at the thing holistically. And you're absolutely right that under the current plan, the savings to employers don't occur until, you know, 20 years from now. Well, we face our fiscal problems far sooner than 20 years. However, the problems, if you were to address retirement in ways that we'll talk about next week, free up a lot of money to address the health, the education, and the municipal revenue sharing issues. So it can't fill the gap, but it helps.
Follow up. David, you mentioned earlier in one of your slides that you were somewhat dismissive of the bond rating agency's view of how we should handle this issue, and I just wanted to give you an opportunity to comment on the value of our bond rating and how a plan that how the legislature going forward on this issue might jeopardize that, and whether it could if we were to do nothing.
Again, through the chair, I didn't mean to dismiss the bond raters. Our rating is important. It allows us to borrow money at a lower rate, and that's important. What I was dismissing was the role of our pension debt in determining that bond rating. The information that I got from the bond rater was that we have large reserves. Clearly, you could pay off this debt if you chose to do so. You have options. You're paying your debt out of current cash flow. There are many things that go into bond ratings, and what I was dismissing was people who would argue that the pension debt is a critical component of the bond ratings. I would not put it as critical. It's one of many, and he said it was a smaller consideration, and they would consider other plans. In other words, we don't look at your funding ratio. You close your system. You're going to be fine. We're not looking right now. When we rate bonds, we don't look at next year. These bonds have 20-year terms. We're looking out 20 years in the future. And your ability to pay, if something you do to retirement affects your ability and improves your financial situation in 20 years, great. But again, I think the point is that pension debt is not the primary component of bond raters that they look at.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a discussion that I think we're going to hear a lot of. You know, we use the term a shared plan and a blended rate. I'm not sure exactly which one refers to which, but when we went to a plan where everybody got lumped together and the state started managing the whole thing as a whole, and we had, you know, an employee might go from Barrow to King Cove to Cordova to some, and we put it all in one pot and no longer differentiated the responsibility. Are you still able to break that out to the obligation for Petersburg or any other small community? You're able to do that. You're able to see actually who has a responsibility of what amount.
Through the chair, I certainly can't do that. Retirement and benefits may have the information to allow you to do that. I mean, we do know where people work, but I don't know if it's put together in a form that would allow you to do that right now, because they would probably look at it as, what's the point? It is a shared cost plan. The whole point of going to shared cost is that we don't have to do that anymore.
Well, if I may, isn't that what you talked about when you were looking at when you did the Anchorage obligation? Isn't that what you were talking about?
No, not at all. They're two completely different issues. One is the way individual employers used to be responsible for individual employees' benefits.
Mm-hmm.
We went away from that, and now it is one big system. And no matter where you worked, you earn the same benefits. It just depends on your pay and your time of service. But you get paid out of a big pool,
right,
rather than having Petersburg pay for some and the North Slope Borough pay for some. What I'm referring to here is this lists payroll, and we can say, let's take the unfunded liability, the debt that we owe, and say, here's your share of that debt. So it's a different thing. It has nothing to do with breaking it down as a responsibility for benefits. And this is the tough thing to understand. You know, if you spend money on a capital project and issue bonds to do it, you've got a debt, but you've got something to show for it. Unfunded liability, you got nothing to show for it. You just lost money, that's all. I mean, it's not like you got a capital project back. You got nothing back for this, except it's the result of an out-and-out loss of money in your portfolio. It's not a purchase. It's not an appropriation.
If I may follow up, I agree with you, and I see that as the case. But you're going to generate a column of numbers there and tell a mayor in St. Paul that this is their obligation. And he's going to tell you that, well, that guy worked for me for 3 years, then went to Anchorage for 5, then went to Petersburg. You're going to have all those mayors saying, that's not my liability. That's a calculation of percentage of the whole. But and maybe I'm completely off, but I've, you know, had this discussion already with some folks. It's like they can no longer calculate exactly what was you know, mine as a mayor, I mean, as the mayor right there, as compared with, you know, a calculation of the division of the larger number by number of workers. But what it really is that I owe, you can't tell me. And I think that's going to be a sticking point, and they're going to come out of the woodwork.
Now, through the chair, we're not, we don't care where anybody worked anymore. We're not, this assignment of liability has nothing to do with the time they served or the money they made anywhere. This assignment to employers has nothing to do with employees. It has to do with, we've got a huge debt because we had investment losses. And your share of that debt, which has, again, nothing to do with anything about service or benefits paid, it has to do with, we lost a bunch of money and here's your share of it.
David, yeah. We can get into that later if you want, but basically I think that that was the question that was raised back in 2006 and 2007, and that's why they went to the shared, which then gets you to this one. So they decided they couldn't answer that question back then, went to the shared, and that's where you get to where you are here right now. Representative Stoltz, do you have a question?
We're going to have lots more time later.
Any further comments, questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, David. Appreciate it.
I've got my comments.
You haven't noticed the meeting
adjourned?
Introductory
meeting. Our next thing is
your bill, right? That's my bill. That's your agenda item, right?
Yes. All right, we are adjourned.
Oh, okay, yeah.